Hey, Tom Switzer here, and welcome to Between the Lines. It's always great to have your company. Now, today on the show, there's been a lot of talk about how millennials feel about socialism. I do hope you don't think I'm a pub bore, but this is a fascinating subject, isn't it? So let's go right to the source and ask a millennial. Joe Sternberg, he will tell us straight. Socialism, smashed avocado, and how he holds the generations before him responsible for the so-called mugging of the millennial. Stay with us for that. When you think of nationalism, what comes to your mind? For Jean-Claude Juncker, he's the European Commission President, the nationalists who have proliferated across Europe in recent times, what did he call them recently? Stupid. For French President Emmanuel Macron, nationalism is a betrayal of patriotism. Yet for many people, nationalism is a badge of honour. It represents simply a love of country, especially in a globalised world. Indeed, Donald Trump recently commemorated the 75th anniversary of D-Day, and he defended the kind of nationalism that won World War II, the kind of nationalism, he implicitly argued, that will be necessary to defeat those waging a war against the West today. My next guest disagrees, and he says that the kind of dangerous nationalism that shapes US foreign policy, well, that can be traced back to Reagan and Bush Jr. Brendan O'Connor is an associate professor at the United States Studies Centre at the University of Sydney. He's a co-editor of a new book called Ideologies of American Foreign Policy. G'day, Brendan. Welcome back to RN.
Good to be talking with you, Tom.
Now, before we address Trump, Bush and Reagan, tell me, why do you think nationalism's a dirty word?
Because nationalism tends to be about domination. It tends to be an argument that my country is the best country, and when you've got such an arsenal of weapons of the United States, simplistic ideas like American exceptionalism, American greatness, America first, those are dangerous ideas because they don't have much nuance about them. They don't have much concern about the details on the ground, and so put into action, those ideas can be ruinous, and I think they were ruinous in Vietnam, they were ruinous in Iraq, in the 2003 war, and you know, in Afghanistan, as I argue in the book at various points in time, because you need a greater degree of detail when you get involved in foreign interventions. And nationalism is a poor policy guide. It's a set of motherhood statements about the sort of benefits of your nation over other nations. And so nationalism needs to be curbed. It needs to be sort of curtailed, is one of the big arguments of the book we're putting forward. And so on its own, it's a prescription for disaster in many regards. It may make people feel committed to their country, rally around the flag, but on its own, beyond the idea of independence and the idea of having a sovereign nation, it's not a foreign policy set of ideas or prescriptions.
But for many liberals in the West who champion this so-called rules-based liberal international order, they all too often refer to the United States that American global leadership is upholding the rules and norms of that liberal international order. So isn't an assertive global America needed to uphold that Pax Americana?
Well, I suppose one of the fallacies of the kind of liberal international order was that America was always doing these things for the benefit of the sort of global system. America, of course, was often doing things for its own benefit, creating a rules-based system that suited it. So you've got to look at the sort of, you know, costs and benefits of any situation. And in those situations, I think those who promote that kind of liberal international order, they forget that all presidents are nationalists, not just Reagan. You know, Clinton was a nationalist. Obama was a nationalist. It's the type of nationalist.
Alternative to American global leadership then?
Well, I suppose some people would argue, and I'd probably be on the side of this, to say that if you're going to have an international sort of order, you're going to have a rules-based system, it has to be more cooperative. You've got to occasionally listen to your allies a lot more. You've got to be really engaged in multilateralism. That has to be a true process. And if you can curb your nationalism, and you've got issues like global warming, which go beyond nations, or refugee problems go beyond nations, you've got to take an internationalist approach. But when nationalism is a guiding force, one of the strong arguments of the book is that it's not a clever set of ideas. Yes. It's not an set of ideas that says, okay, I'm really interested in how things are in Iraq between the Shia and the Sunni, or in Afghanistan between the various factions. It's a set of ideas that sort of tends to run on the lines of, we know what's best for you. We need to assert our domination here. And it comes with an overconfidence, a hubris. Through the sort of period of history we look at in the book, from 1945 really up to the Obama administration, you know, there's been some pretty unfortunate things that the United States has done in terms of military intervention, which has often been pushed by a type of nationalism that hasn't been for the good of the world or for the United States, for that fact.
My guest is Associate Professor Brendan O'Connor from the University of Sydney's United States Studies Centre, and we're chatting about a new book he's co-edited, which is called The Ideologies of American Foreign Policy. Now, Brendan, in your book, you dedicate chapters to the Reagan and W. Bush presidency. What distinguishes Reagan foreign policy from W. Bush foreign policy?
Well, I think they both start out with this belief that freedom is a magical concept that the United States can spread to the rest of the world. They have a different threat. It's anti-communism that's Reagan's big concern. And then after September 11 with Bush, it's terrorism. But over time, Reagan is moderated. He's moderated by his Secretary of State, George Shultz. He's moderated by his concern that some kind of accident or misunderstanding will lead to nuclear war. And he engages, as we famously know, in negotiations with Gorbachev to reduce tensions, to bring a form of arms control in. But he doesn't stop being a nationalist. Some of the sort of books that I was arguing against, what I wrote in the Reagan chapter was, he doesn't stop, you know, trying to promote America's position to its fullest. He doesn't stop various foreign interventions in Nicaragua and Afghanistan that are, particularly in Afghanistan, have a long sort of a long tail to them that we're still seeing today. So it's a combination. Where Bush, I don't think there's this kind of moderation. I mean, there's realists there in this latter part of his presidency. You get Condoleezza Rice, you get Robert Gates playing a role. But Bush, the hubris is stronger, and the belief in this kind of magical sort of notion of freedom, which is sort of pushed by a particular type of American exceptionalism and nationalism, isn't moderated to the same extent, and more moderation of those ideas, I think, would have been beneficial.
And the neoconservatives in the Bush administration who championed aggressive unilateralism, regime change, preventive war, many of those neoconservatives and their predecessors, they slammed Reagan in the 1980s for his seeming restraint. I mean, he lifted Carter's grain embargo on the Soviet Union. I think Reagan withdrew U.S. troops from Lebanon in 1983 when he saw a quagmire looming. Mm-hmm. So are there significant differences here between Reagan and Bush?
Yes, that was fascinating to look back on, how much criticism Reagan received for negotiating with Gorbachev. You know, he was seen as naive, that he was falling into a trap.
A modern day Neville Chamberlain.
That, you know, he needed the hard line that he'd followed up to 1984 would have been the better approach. And those people, I think, were wrong. And so for them to come back a generation later and say, okay, well, the best approach is this kind of unilateralist, interventionist approach, reminds us that we've got short memories. And this is one of the fun things and important things about writing historical books, is that we've got to learn something from these mistakes. They're not mistakes which are circumstantial or, you know, if only there were more troops that we might come to. They're mistakes that changing other nations is fundamentally very difficult. No one wants the idea of a nuclear war. No one wins from that. And those are pretty much permanent lessons from history or realities. And so for people like the neoconservatives under the Bush Jr. administration to come back and say, okay, we can reorder the world. We've got so much power that we can change nations. We can democratize nations. We can change the nature of the Middle East. From our experience of the interventions of the Reagan period, there should have been a lot of concern to say, look, changing other nations is very unlikely.
The widespread consensus, Brendan, and you and I have reflect this orthodoxy for more than a decade since we've known each other, is that the Bush doctrine led to the disaster in Iraq, and by all accounts, it has been a disaster. But the neoconservative get-out clause is that Washington, the Bush administration, did not commit enough troops to the venture in the first place. Plausible?
I think we had this argument in Vietnam as well. If there was only more troops, if there was only more bombing, and that led to the disaster of, you know, over 1 million people were killed in that war in Vietnam, the death toll would have gone up. There would have been maybe periods of America holding Iraq, as they did in the surge to some extent, but those things would be temporary. I mean, you had a resentful population that was not embracing the United States. There were, you know, outbreaks of fighting of Shia forces very early on in that war attacking American soldiers. Now, the Americans are supposed to be the ones liberating the Shia against the against Saddam Hussein's sort of Sunni Ba'athist party. And so there was already signs of that the Americans were not going to be seen as liberators, and there would be a resentment. So there was obviously, you know, it was a mess.
Yes, and it gets back to your point about nationalism, because there was a widespread consensus in Washington that democracy was an export commodity to Iraq. Mm-hmm. And if anyone had studied their history of this part of the world, they recognized that Iraq was an artificial construct, that it was ethnically and tribally divided, and it was going to be very hard to sort of create a viable liberal democratic state out of the ruins of the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. But in fairness to the Bush administration, didn't that surge in 2007 work in creating a significant degree of stability and relative peace in Iraq? And it wasn't until President Obama's troop withdrawal, this is Bush's successor, his withdrawal in 2011, that's what created the strategic vacuum that allowed Sunni jihadists such as Islamic State to exploit.
Well, I mean, Al-Qaeda Iraq wasn't a new thing when Obama came along. There'd been, you know, Sadr City and other parts of Iraq that had been, you know, the danger of Al-Qaeda had been there before the danger of ISIS arose. I mean, the question would have been how many troops for how long? And that wasn't sustainable politically. There was no appetite, as you know, in the United States for that. The sensible and necessary solution was a political solution, but the factionalism of Iraq was so profound that achieving that political solution has been incredibly difficult. And so, as you know, was it America's role to stay there with a huge number of troops for a very long time? Would that have created more resentment at some point? Yes. And so, and we've had that situation in Afghanistan.
One politician in the United States who's clearly caught the significance of this war-weary mood in the United States was Donald Trump. He ran on a campaign of America First. Now, that's hardly the same thing as Bush's crusade to promote democracy across the globe. But you nevertheless put Trump and Bush in the same camp in the sense that they embrace American nationalism. But on foreign policy, they're poles apart, aren't they, Brendan?
Well, I think with both of them, there's a tendency to see America as this kind of mighty power in the world, the greatest power, the greatest nation in the world, and that power is sometimes going to have to be used through military force. So I think Trump sees, like Bush and Reagan to some extent, the US military as a problem-solving sort of tool, and that's flows out of, I think, a particular confidence that America's role in the world. Now, you're certainly right that Trump is more reluctant to intervene. He's certainly not an interventionist in the period that we've seen him as president to this point.
Leaving aside the bombing on Damascus.
But yes.
That
was an example of, I suppose, that sort of, you know, instinctive belief that the military can solve particular problems. But the potential is there with Trump. Mm. I mean, I don't think many of us were very comforted in the period where he talked about fire and fury towards North Korea. The potential was there to say this guy will see a kind of potential military solution as a way of sending a message. Now, thankfully, that brinkmanship has been pulled back from, and we're not at that point. But I don't think we should say, well, with Trump, he would never intervene, or he has a form of, he is not a nationalist in a way that is potentially dangerous.
But you're not suggesting interventionism is always wrong, though, are you?
In most cases, I think seeing military intervention as a problem solver, unless it's a sort of the last resort, there's no sort of record of success in that regard.
What about Kosovo and Bosnia in the 1990s?
Yeah, no, I mean, I think the record is mixed. Yeah. I think in times of extreme desperation, the Rwandan conflict, could have an international force saved people's lives there? Yes, possibly. But it has to be sort of done in this way that's, you know, so sophisticated and thoughtful that it doesn't have these unintended consequences that you get, you know, you do get in the Bosnian incident. You don't, you know, plenty of people, innocent people die in that situation. You know, there's still people arguing the benefits and the costs of that intervention.
Brendan, we could keep going. Great to see you again.
My pleasure. Great to talk with you.
Well, that was Brendan O'Connor. He's an associate professor at the United States Studies Centre at the University of Sydney, and he's the co-author of a new book called Ideologies of American Foreign Policy, and we'll put a link to that book on our website. You're an RN.